Hello and welcome to the Third Sector podcast. I'm Rebecca Cooney, Senior Features and Analysis Writer.
And I'm Emily Burt, Editor of Third Sector, the UK's leading publication for the voluntary and not-for-profit sector.
Each month, we're delving a little deeper into some of the conversations being had in our community, learning more about exciting innovations and probing some of the issues we're facing.
In this month's bumper special episode, we are talking to Carl Wilding, the Chief Executive of the National Council for Voluntary Organisations, about his first year in the role.
And we'll be chatting to the poet Holly McNish about her work with Homestart in a slightly different edition of our coronavirus care package. That's all to come. But first...
Previously on Third Sector...
It's January. It's the longest January in living memory.
It's the longest January that's ever occurred. It is quite extraordinary. We're not even out of it yet. And I remember coming back into the office on January 3rd and it was like World War III was trending.
Yeah. Australia's on fire.
Australia's completely on fire.
Australia's on fire.
Australia, no more Australia, no more koalas. We've had fractions in the royal house.
Labour leadership contest.
Yeah, need a new Labour leader. That's not even going to be decided until March. So we're not even a third of the way through that whole process yet. Allegedly, the Saudi Crown Prince has hacked Jeff Bezos in some really recent weird news.
Yeah.
Probably wanted like a really nice Amazon deal. And finally, we've got this fun virus, which is spreading from China. So So that's where we're up to.
Oh, my poor, sweet, sweet summer children. You know, I could actually remember sitting in the studio to record this and thinking, should I even mention this virus? Because I don't want people to think that I'm fear-mongering. Now, here we are. In fact, Rebecca, for our listeners, could you just describe what you're looking at right now?
What I'm looking at is... Emily, or the top, kind of the bottom two thirds of Emily's face on her screen. And then she's kind of swathed in a crown or like a cloak of blanket draped across her head with headphones recording into her phone, because that's how we record the podcast now. But yeah, she's like some kind of like mysterious nun.
Yeah. Coming from the future with a terrible, terrible message for those much younger and far more stable people recording in January 2020. I just, you know, I can't believe that we were talking about Jeff Bezos getting his Amazon account hacked like it was a newsworthy thing.
We were face to face. We were looking at each other.
And with guests.
Yeah, with guests, with people we don't live with. We went for lunch after this was recorded. We left the studio and we went to a crowded noodle bar where my elbows were basically on some stranger's table, almost in their soup. And we probably hugged Anushka, our producer at the time. We hugged people. And then at some point around that time, I booked a trip to the Netherlands in March and a trip to Barcelona in April, being like, yeah, it's fine. There's this virus, but that's in Italy, which is miles away from Spain. It'll be fine.
I was 6 months away from my wedding. My June wedding, my midsummer wedding. I went home. I was worrying about whether I wanted duck egg napkins or dove grey napkins. And oh my goodness. I mean, we all know this year has turned things upside down, but this particular audio blast from the past, I feel like I'm realizing all over again that we were in a completely different place at the beginning of this year. It is just extraordinary. And before we do anything else on this episode, I want to say to anybody who's listening, this year is nearly over. We are so, so nearly there. And everybody just deserves a massive rest.
We do. We do. So, you know, pour yourself a cup of tea or something stronger. It's the Christmas edition. Normally we drink Baileys in the studio.
Yes, we do. We normally have all kinds of, again, it's a Christmas like no other Christmas, but this is our final festive episode of the year. So do settle in, relax and reflect on what a long way we've come since January this year. Carl Wilding has been chief executive of the NCVO since September last year. He has worked at the umbrella body since 1998 and succeeded Sir Stuart Etherington as chief executive when he retired after 25 years in role.
No one could have predicted the direction the past year would take, and like many third sector organisations, NCVO has not made it out of the pandemic unscathed. The body is currently undergoing a restructure that will reduce the number of directors from 3 to 2 and lead to the likely loss of 22 of the organisation's 107 roles.
So Rebecca sat down with Carl to chat about his reflections on the past year, on where the sector is at the moment, and how he hopes 2021 will pan out.
So, Carl, thank you very much for joining us. It's not been the year that anybody predicted. So what do you think have been the biggest challenges for you as chief executive of the NCVO?
First, Rebecca, thanks for hosting. It's really good to have a conversation with you. You're right, it's not been the year that any of us predicted, has it? Anyone, not just in the sector, but externally. I think our challenges at NCVO and I guess therefore mine as chief exec have been very similar faced by our members. So we've had an external shock in the form of the COVID pandemic, and the challenge there being the need to respond to the crisis phase of the pandemic by completely changing not only our priorities to respond to what people needed, but also changing how we work. I mean, shifting from an organisation of 100 or so people where everyone comes into the office every day to one where almost overnight we are all not all, but many of us have been working at home. That's been challenging. Clearly, again, like our members and the sector out there as a whole, there's been a huge challenge in terms of the financial model that we operate on and the hit that COVID has delivered to our financial model. So normal trading activities, conferences, all those sorts of things, they have either been impossible as a result of lockdown, or social distancing rules have fundamentally sort of changed them and sort of made them extremely difficult. So you can probably talk to any number of chief execs in the sector at the minute who will say, hey, our online events are brilliant. We're getting 5 times as many people as we were before. But what's the business model behind the new ways of working where your events are on Zoom and so on? So a real challenge there in terms of financial models for all of us. I mean, none of us are out of the woods yet on that one. You know, who knows how long it's going to be before we can start to do events and community fundraising and so on together as a sector again. And then a big challenge for us, and again for our members, I think this year has been about trying to plan for the future. And the fact that we are having to change the size and the focus of our organisation so that we can live within our means and become a COVID resilient organisation in the future. I'm very much of the view that the virus is here to stay. So we've got to try and find a way of working with it whilst it's sort of going to be alongside us for the foreseeable future. Coming to your question about challenge, for me and for us, that's been an incredibly sad challenge on a personal level, because it means that we have made people redundant at NCVO, and no leader wants to be someone who is in charge of a process where people are leaving your organisation through a redundancy process. And in our case, you know, I mean, brilliant leaders in our sector who are leaving, and that's a sort of a huge challenge. So sort of wrapping all that up, I guess, you know, I mean, the challenge that everyone is facing right now in the middle of December, right across the sector, is that whether your leaders, trustees, staff, everyone is very, very tired. I mean, that is the constant feedback I am getting from everyone. People are weary.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And the response to the pandemic, it seems to me, or the response to these challenges has been marked by this kind of unprecedented level of collaboration among umbrella organisations. I don't know if that's looked the same from where you're sitting, but I've certainly never heard it or never seen it come to fruition quite as clearly as it has done in recent months. Do you think that that's something that can be preserved beyond the pandemic? And I appreciate what you're saying about the pandemic's going to be here to stay for a long time anyway, but do you think that can be preserved into the future?
Well, first of all, I think those unprecedented levels of collaboration, I don't think that's just infrastructure organisations, first of all. I actually think that's across sectors as well. You know, when you've got van hire rental firms coming to you saying, what can we do? We've got vans that no one's hiring and we want to put those to socially useful things. When even sort of now, you know, I mean, if you open the newspaper today, you have a national fast food company that operates at a global scale, saying, hey, during the crisis, we're okay, actually, but we want you to visit some of our rivals who are the small businesses on the high street. Yeah, there's something very different about the nature of collaboration in society, where we all recognise that actually the only way we're going to get through this as a society is by coming together and helping each other. So what you call the unprecedented collaboration between umbrella bodies, I think that's just reflective of a broader trend. I think the other thing I would say about the collaboration is that it didn't start with COVID. It started before. Not that anyone would sort of see this, and not that it's necessarily important, but we were starting to come together before COVID, albeit not as many of us, but we were starting conversations about how do we work together. And I think that's because we all have a recognition, especially those of us who are membership organisations, that our members expect us to work together in their interests. To coin a phrase, they are not our members, we are their membership bodies. I think it's incumbent upon us to work together, and I think everyone gets that. So regardless of any sort of individual, in terms of sort of this collaboration, whoever the chief exec's holding the baton at this point in time happened to be, I think the collaboration's going to continue, because I think it has to. I think the world's changed. We're in a world now of new power and networks, where networks are much more important than they were a generation ago. So I think because of those wider trends, I think it's going to carry on. So the challenge for us is, how do we make sure that we preserve that? How do you sort of embed the culture? How do you embed the working methods? How do you make sure that these relationships are not just personal and individual, but they are organisational, and that they span different sort of levels in sort of the hierarchies that we have as organisations? So some of that's about codifying relationships and writing down ways of working. Some of it, I think, is about celebrating it. Some of it is about recognising that, especially as membership organisations, there is actually an awful lot that we can and should collaborate about, and it's not just about campaigning. The most visible sort of things that people see over the last sort of 9 months is probably that sort of campaigning type stuff that we do. But actually, for me, going forward, some of the much more important things that we should do in terms of collaboration actually is about how we support our members. It's about the services that we deliver, the practical support. And the reason that I say that is because there is never going to be enough capacity building resource to go around. There's never going to be enough practical support to go around. So I think it's more important than ever that we are clear about the different roles we play, trying not to sort of duplicate each other if that duplication is wasteful. And then sort of collaborating on things like making sure that we have a clear understanding of what user need is and actually what works when it comes to delivering services to members, because we all want to deliver the best possible practical support to people.
Yeah. Okay. And I mean, I totally hear what you're saying about that the collaboration goes beyond the campaigning, but obviously I think one of the kind of the biggest sort of public facing, or the kind of the thing that is most visible from the outside, is some of the campaigning around sort of never more needed. Is that getting the kind of cut through that it could do with the public? Does it need to be getting that kind of cut through? And you know, do we need to be doing more with it?
I mean, sort of what strikes me is what's cutting through to the public is that in a time of crisis is that people need help and support, and that people are responding. And I think they're recognising that it's not that charities are never more needed, but it's the work of charities and volunteers that's never more needed. And that's always been the emphasis of our campaign and what we've said. It's, if you go back to the sort of the very beginning when we were asking for financial support from government, it wasn't because we said that we have some sort of divine right to exist and to continue, but people do have a right to the services that organisations provide, because many of them are providing statutory services, or they're doing things that in previous years the state may have done. And that is where there is a responsibility. That is what is sort of never more needed. So if you start from the position that it's the services that are important, it's less important that we focus on this idea that the sector has to get recognised. I think that's probably not the right way to look at it. What's important is that people need services, and that they have a right and deserve those services. So I think the public do recognise that we're doing things, and you look at especially some of the most visible things in people's lives where they can really sort of connect and relate to the things that our sector does. So, you know, in the idea that you might not have a meal at the end of the day. So people have gone the extra mile in terms of supporting food banks. The idea that we ourselves might be lonely and on our own. So these acts of neighbourliness and kindness that we've seen, I think sort of people are recognising that. I would argue to you that what has cut through is are the things that charities and volunteers are doing. I think our local news, our national news, it's hard to pick up a paper these days where you cannot see what people are doing to support good causes in their community. And for me, that's what's important that cuts through, is almost the idea, the concept that actually doing something in your community, it's part of being a citizen. So the challenge for us as organisations is to then sort of make that logical link so that we can sort of make the case that we are there and we are helping mobilise and organise the good things that people want to do in their community. And the conversations that we've got to have a lot of the time are about the fact that when people want to make a difference, they can do it. They can make a difference on their own, but they can make a much bigger difference when they're part of something bigger and they're organized and they get support in the form of whether it's training or safeguarding and so on. So in that sense, that the sort of the charity layer, it is critical. And I think we've still probably got a bit more work to do in explaining why sort of that role in organising and mobilising is needed, as well as the good work of individuals.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense. The government's response to the pandemic has been very widely criticised as far as charities are concerned, the support that's been available for charities. And NCVO has historically perhaps had a reputation for taking quite a strategic approach when working with government, working alongside it, taking what kind of some people would think of as sort of inside track rather than vocally criticising it. Is that still your approach, and is that going to be a useful or has that been a useful strategy in 2020?
So you're right. People have been critical at times of government, and I think they've been rightly critical at times of government. At the very beginning, we said that that because of what the sector does in terms of providing services to the public and supporting them through the crisis, it would need support that would be swift, simple and substantial. And it's a mixed record in terms of what they've done. And I think what we have to make sure that we do as a sector is balance the times when government gets it wrong. And you know, we all get things wrong, but including government. Government has not sat on its hands with regard to the sector. It has provided support and it has listened. But it's not always got things right, and I think where sometimes we probably need to shape our critique of government at times a bit more is recognizing that government has had to respond massively at pace in the middle of a crisis when they have got some of the similar challenges that we have in terms of like staff working from home and so on. But coming back to your question, Rebecca, about does NCVO take a strategic approach? Well, I'd like to think that we're always going to be strategic in our approach to working with government. But the strategy will change according to the times that you live and work in. And as you've sort of pointed out, sometimes what's effective in terms of influencing is taking more of an insider approach. Sometimes it's about being sort of more on the outside. And then the reality, I think, that we all recognise is that it's a blend, isn't it? And that you will pick your moments when you want to take an outsider approach. But when you are working sort of in sort of more influencing mode, I think where we are thinking about how we evolve our approach is, as a membership organisation, how do we work much more closely with our members and using the access and the influence and the privilege that we have from being a national membership body to bring them with us and use our platform, if that's the right, or our access, to put them to the front. I think if I'm being honest, probably most ministers and civil servants, they probably don't want to hear from national umbrella body bodies. What they actually want to hear are voices from the front line who have got the real lived experience of how policy is impacting upon what they do. So for me, I think what it means is that at times we will challenge government, if for no other reason that we need to challenge government, because I know many people still feel frustrated that government is actually missing out on huge opportunities by not working with our sector and not recognising the solutions that volunteering and that charities often bring. At other times, I think that's going to be about us informing government, letting them know about the problems that you don't always know about when you're based in Whitehall. So for us, that's about being a better national organisation with strong links to all of our members. And, you know, government needs that informing. I think the Secretary of State the other day, in his speech at the launch of the Pro Bono Economics Law Family Commission on the future of civil society, I think he said that government acknowledges that it doesn't always have the strategic understanding of our sector that it needs, and it doesn't always understand our contribution. So we've got to do more to sort of fix that, because I would recognise that. The other thing that I would say is, in terms of a strategic approach to sort of government, is that we've got to make sure that we've got answers and solutions to sort of these problems that are faced by society. I generally have the view that people who either become sort of officials or get elected to government, they tend to want to do those roles because they want to make the world a better place. And they're looking for solutions just as much as we are. So we've got to make sure, a bit like Ndidi Kazi said the other day, that we've got to... we've got to get better at communicating hope and offering hope. I would agree with that. But the twin sister of hope is answers and solutions. So I'm a great believer in that old phrase that the best critique is a better solution. So yes, we should absolutely hand out criticism when it's needed. But we've then got to follow that up with ideas about how to do things differently and better.
So you mentioned there sort of members, your members, and kind of giving your members more of a platform and their voices being heard. How are you tackling issues around diversity, power and privilege, both within NCVO and through its position in the sector?
Well, I hope that we're tackling these issues with determination, with humility, and with a recognition that we ourselves have got a lot to learn. And indeed, we have a lot to change. I think the trustees and the senior leadership at NCVO would also acknowledge that it's our staff from across the organisation, from the bottom upwards, who actually have been the driving force behind tackling these issues internally and indeed externally. When you know, I mean, you see some of the blogs that have appeared on the NCVO website. So they are the people that I sort of want to acknowledge and indeed celebrate as sort of driving some of this stuff. We've done some practical changes in terms of this agenda. So on equity, diversity, and inclusion, the board have now set up their own subcommittee. With our new structure to deliver our strategy, we're putting in place a new people, governance and culture team, because we're going to take much more interest and pay much more attention to cultural change in the organisation. And then just some sort of like quite practical things that maybe aren't as widespread as you would think in the sector. So as we've been making changes to our workforce and we are going through a redundancy process, we spent a lot of time on an equality impact assessment to make sure that we can sort of take good quality decisions. I mean, there are wider things that we need to do as well. It's not just about human resources. It's about thinking about our membership, about policy development. So I think the point that I'm sort of trying to say here is that the conversations that we're having internally is that how can we not just do quick wins? How can we not just do things that are really simple, but probably are only change at sort of surface level? And instead, how can we undertake that deep and lasting cultural change? And again, I want to emphasise that lots of the learning here and lots of the drive, this is coming from NCVO staff who have got lived experience of oppression and discrimination.
That makes a lot of sense. And it does just seem to me that at the same time the sector is facing kind of the massive challenge of the pandemic, we've also seen organisations having to think about getting their own houses in order. You know, we've had a number of high profile allegations of bullying, institutional racism. How should the sector be balancing these two issues, the kind of COVID crisis on one hand and the need for massive soul searching on the other?
Yeah, well, these aren't either or issues, aren't they, Rebecca? I mean, COVID, for example, I think has sparked huge concerns about mental health, not just in voluntary sector, but in the public sector as well. So if you've got these challenges already in your organisation, if you have sort of these internal issues, you know, COVID is sort of going to widen the cracks, isn't it? And they're going to become a problem. So you have to deal with them together. I guess ultimately, what we've got to do is that we've got to make sure that we're operating based on ethical principles, which is something NCVO has argued for some time. There's no point surviving the COVID sort of crisis and being being financially intact if you do so at the expense of not taking care of how you treat your staff and ensuring that you're living your values.
Brilliant. So just as a final question before we wrap up, if 2020 has taught us anything, it's that making predictions for the future is a risky business, although, as we've said, perhaps we should have known that some of this was coming. But I'm going to ask you to do it all the same. So what are your predictions for 2021, both for NCVO and for the wider sector?
I think it's probably better, actually, Rebecca, to think in terms of risks and opportunities rather than predictions. So clearly, what happens in terms of sort of COVID and how long social distancing rules are going to last for is a really big thing for most charities, and that will have a material impact on their future, because when the vaccine is available and we can return to sort of more normal sort of ways of fundraising and working, that's going to have a big impact on our financial models. So is that the summer? Is it earlier? Yeah, that's a key issue. Likewise, Brexit and what's happening in the next couple of weeks, and the potential risk to supply chains in the future. So even if it's just as simple as you're an organisation that that makes meals for people, what's going to happen to the supply chain, I think, is important. Another big sort of milestone in the next year is the end of March. And I point to that because that's when the furlough scheme ends. So what happens then to the wider economy and unemployment, and what will that do in terms of confidence? Because if confidence in the wider economy takes a dip, I think that will sort of have an impact. But I want to be optimistic about 2021 and to conclude and sort of say, I think what we've seen from 2020 and COVID is that people care about the world around them and they care about others. So what I think we probably can predict is that people still want to sort of do things that help others, and it's our challenge in the future to make sure that we are there to sort of turn and mobilise and organise that goodwill and that desire to help others and turn that into impact.
Each month we put together a coronavirus care package of good news, and this month we thought we would bring you something a little different after one campaign in particular caught our eye.
So the charity Homestart, which is a community network of trained volunteers and experts who help families with young children through challenging times, is working with the poet Holly McNish. She's donating 50% of the profits from her poem You Don't Need a Chimney to Homestart, and she agreed to chat to me about this uplifting and distinctly Christmassy campaign. Hi Holly, thanks very much for joining us. I should note that I'm having to record you over the phone at the moment, so it might be that the audio quality is not as high as it would be in the studio, so I hope our listeners will forgive us for that. I was wondering if you could kick us off by reading out the poem that you've written for Homestart.
Yeah, of course I can. So it's a poem basically inspired by Homestart and that I wrote for my daughter, and it's called You Do Not Need a Chimney for Santa Claus to Come. You do not need a chimney for Santa Claus to come. You do not need a fireplace to hang your stocking from. That stuff is just from telly. Do not believe the films. You do not need a great big house for Santa to come in. He's got a sleigh, for goodness sake, and loads of elves at hand. Mrs. Claus behind the scenes computing all the plans. Flying, glowing reindeer galloping the Christmas air. Of course, he can manage a few quick flights of stairs. The top flat of a tower block. The barge on a canal, a spare room in a friend's house, a hostel, a hotel. So snuggle into sleep now and don't listen to anyone who says you need a chimney for Santa Claus to come.
Oh, thank you so much. And so what inspired the poem?
It was two things, I guess. So I've got a daughter who's 10 now, and we basically lived in a flat when she was little and then live in a terrace house with her now. And every year at Christmas, she basically worries about Santa Claus getting in. Not worried about him getting in, but worried about how he'd get in, basically. And I sort of realised that all of our ideas of Christmas, or her ideas, were based on this very wealthy US film industry, basically. And then about 5 years ago, I discovered Homestart when I was a newish parent, I guess. And I was looking at all the work they did. So it's a kind of mix of trying to ease my daughter's worry about the myth of Christmas and the story of Christmas and how this stocking or present would be delivered. But then also just thinking about this idea of home and how, I guess, television and media kind of portrays especially around Christmas, this idea of home as having to be this certain type of family, normally married, heterosexual couple, in a massive house with a big fireplace and so many decorations, but actually that there are kids all over the world, all over the UK, in terms of Home Start to Work, who are in various different types of housing, some unstable, some very small, some spare rooms in friends' houses. I write a lot of poems, but there didn't seem to be that many kind of Christmassy ones written for kids who live in different places. And I've thought this about a lot of kids' films and books. There's not that much diversity of kind of wealth, I guess, in a lot of them. So, it was a combination of that. And I love Christmas. I really love it. I'm quite obsessed with it. And I love the story of Santa Claus. I know not everybody does, but I love the idea that there's this story about every kid getting one gift or one stocking. And I think we've sort of messed it up, like rich parents buy 50 gifts and say that they're all from Santa Claus, as if their richer kids are like nicer than poorer kids, basically. And I think it could be so lovely. I just think we need to diversify it a little bit.
No, that makes a lot of sense. So tell us about the campaign with Home Start. What does it involve, and how are you using the poem to raise money for Home Start?
So the campaign is Give a Little Love campaign, which they're doing in partnership with Fair Share, which is a food charity. People get access to the food that they need, and also with John Lewis and Waitrose. So they're encouraging people, basically, to donate a little bit of love at Christmas and give a little bit of kindness, which I really like that it's not all about products or merchandise to sell, and just about giving either your time, if you've got it, which I guess personally as a mother in lockdown at the moment, trying to juggle everything, I didn't feel like I had as much time to volunteer, but yeah, time or money, basically, to try to share the wealth, especially, well, all year round, but especially now. And I think in terms of Home Start, the reason I like it as a charity, I discovered them 5 years ago when I won a poetry award where you got given £5,000 basically as an award, and I wanted to donate some of that to a charity. And as a new parent, I really like the fact that their campaign and their outlook encourages volunteers to basically help families with whatever. It's it's not like prescribed what it is that you need as a family or what it is that you'd be struggling with. So it could be blankets for a new baby or essential items when you come home from the hospital, but it also could just be time or just making dinner or, you know, whatever you need. And I think that for me, that's the most important. I remember being a new parent and thinking, but I don't want this gift. I just want you to cook me dinner, or I just want you to hold the baby. There is like 1,000 different things that families struggle with. And I just like the fact that it's concentrated on kind of helping somebody to create a home and to help them in the way that they need.
Oh, brilliant. And so in terms of raising money, there's a kind of printout people can buy of the poem that kids can colour in and decorate, that's sort of selling on Etsy, isn't there? Is there any other way that the poem's sort of generating income?
So that's it at the moment. It was a very kind of quick idea because I saw this Give a Little Love campaign and I thought, I want to do something to help, basically. So I got in touch with the artist, Bryony Dick, who I love her art, and discovered her. Basically, she was one of the first people that I saw drawing mermaids and fairies with brown skin, basically, which was always a struggle to find when my daughter was little. And we created basically a printout that you can put up on your kid's wall to get from Etsy, or the PDF download, which is, it's hopefully something that we'll just carry on doing every year, and kind of acknowledging that kids do like poetry, but maybe not so much. Like, I'm not going to fool myself as a poet that all kids love poetry. So basically, we wanted to create something, I guess this sounds a bit blunt, that kids could feel better reading, especially kids that do not live in a house with a big fireplace and stuff, but that they could also do an activity that would maybe keep them quiet for half an hour for their parents or for their teachers, basically. So yeah, I wanted to make something that parents could actually use or teachers could use. So it's a PDF and it's £6, and 50% of the proceeds go to Home Start and 50% to the artist. But it's something that they can print out, so if teachers want to use it or people working in any sort of youth organisation can just pay for the PDF and then use it however much and whatever, in whatever way they want, basically.
Brilliant. And we'll pop the link to the Etsy page in the show notes as well so that people can download that.
Great. I've heard it takes a while to colour in, so just... We tried to make it quite intricate.
Brilliant. So, yeah, that's a good, solid Christmas activity while people are stuck inside at the moment. That sounds pretty perfect.
I think so, yeah. I was quite grateful for any sort of activity that, yeah, made me feel like I was educating my child a bit, but also made it quiet.
Brilliant. So we've talked a little bit about what it is you hope for the project, but I just wondered if there was anything else you wanted to add.
I don't think so. Just to thank everybody that's downloaded it. It's been, the download has been really successful, actually. And we weren't sure if people would want to do a simple colouring in sheet, but that's been really nice. So hopefully something that we'll do each Christmas and carry on, and Home Start can gain from it.
And that is it for us this year. So long, farewell, 2020 podcasts. This has been a real experience. I'm tired. Rebecca is tired. Everyone is tired.
Normally, at the end of an episode, we thank our listeners during the sign-off, and I just want to take this moment to say that we really do mean it. I had a Christmas card email from someone in the sector saying thank you for the work we've been doing, and it did actually move me to tears. It's been such a tough year for the sector and for everyone in it, so thank you so much to our listeners and to our readers for taking the time out to read our work, to listen to it, to let us pick your brains, and for letting us know when we've got it right. It really does mean a lot. You're doing an amazing job, and we've still got such a tough road ahead of us, but we are going to get there.
I really could not agree more with Rebecca. It is our absolute privilege, and I mean that on behalf of everyone at Third Sector, to be able to work with all of you. We could not ask for a better audience.
We'll be back with another episode soon, so make sure you subscribe to this, the Third Sector podcast, on your favourite podcast app to be the first to know about it.
We will see you again in the new year. And until then, I'm Emily Burt.
And I'm Rebecca Cooney. Thank you so much to our guests, Carl Wilding and Holly McNish, and to our producer, Lindsay Riley at Rethink Audio.
And however you are celebrating this festive season, we hope you are safe, we hope you are happy and well, and we will see you all again in the new year. Merry, Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.